Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, the author of Citizens of London, the Americans who stood with Britain in its darkest, finest hour. Lynn Olson is the author of this wonderful book. She's a former Moscow correspondent for the Associated Press, White House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, author of Troublesome Young Men and Freedom's Daughters, and co-author with her husband of A Question of Honor and The Murrow Boys. This particular book is about three people, two of whom are probably better known than the third. Best known, Edward R. Murrow, head of CBS Radio's European Bureau after 1937, and incredibly influential, very good friend of Winston Churchill's, and incredibly influential in letting the American people know, and probably the Roosevelt administration know, what how important it was for England to be getting help in their effort to fight the Nazis. Also, John Wynant, who is not as well known. Joseph Kennedy, who was ambassador to Britain, was better known. But Wynant was the American ambassador appointed by FDR in 1941, who helped craft the British-American alliance. And Averill Harriman, who was in charge overseeing the Lend-Lease program sent by Roosevelt in 1941. And we're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, as we always do. The number here, and I'm sure that many of you know this time in history quite well, and you'll find this an absorbing book, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email this hour, please do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
It's just a terrific book. It really is.
Oh, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I just enjoyed it so much. Of course, my hero, and many of us in broadcasting, my hero is one of the stars of the book. So, but you also write it very well. If you don't mind, I'd like to start with Edward R. Murrow.
Sure.
I had no idea that he was instrumental at a very young age in helping to bring some German scientists who were going to be facing persecution to the United States.
That's right. I mean, that was really his first job, his real first adult job. He worked for an organization that was involved as Hitler rose to power in Germany in getting scientists and other intellectuals out of Germany and other countries that were threatened by Hitler and bring them to the U.S. And he considered that, he later said that he considered that to be the most satisfying experience he ever had.
He had an open-door policy with Winston Churchill, which is quite remarkable. Tell me how that happened.
Well, Winston Churchill was incredibly good at wooing people that he needed. And in 1940, 1941, when Britain was really on the brink of disaster, on the brink of defeat at the hands of Germany, he wooed Americans relentlessly. And the three most important Americans, at least in the early part of the war, in London, were the three men that you mentioned who really are at the heart of my book, and Murrow being one of them because he had such an incredible impact on American public opinion. So Churchill set out to basically, court him, as he did the other two. And he basically had an open-door policy where Murrow was concerned. When Murrow wanted to broadcast live from the rooftops of London and the British government said no, he went to Churchill, and Churchill said yes, because, again, he knew how important Murrow was. And that closeness extended to, actually, Murrow would go to 10 Downing Street, and the two of them would have, as Churchill would say, several whiskeys together and discuss what was going on. So there was a closeness there that is really quite remarkable for any journalist and any politician.
Gauge, if you would, how important Murrow was to changing American opinion. His broadcasts, those of us who are in broadcasting, find them riveting. They were beautiful. There is question, and we'll talk about this, as to whether or not he was advocating for a certain position. He was telling the truth of what was happening there, but he did have a certain position. How influential were his words?
Oh, he was extraordinarily influential. I mean, he was broadcasting during the Blitz and the Battle of Britain in 1940, when Britain really was, as I said, really just about to be to go down the tubes. And he made very clear in his broadcasts without overtly saying this, but the underlying tone of the message was that that Britain had to be saved, that America had to do considerably more than what it was doing at that point, certainly in giving more aid and even to the extent of going to war. And as you indicated, he really did cross the line. I mean, he was not objective, and he made no bones about it. He said that there could be no objectivity at a time like this, that you couldn't balance right and wrong, that Hitler and the Nazis were inescapably wrong, they were inescapably evil, and that you couldn't give them equal time. And it came across to the American people. I mean, he was incredibly influential, and what he told his American listeners, they listened to, and they absorbed it, and they responded. And polls showed that in the course of a few months that American public opinion did start swinging toward certainly helping Britain more than what we had been doing up to that point. And Murrow was given much of the credit by FDR and other people.
I think you cite one of those polls, and it was, what, 30-some percent, and a year later, or maybe even not a year later, it went up to 54% in
right.
favor of America becoming involved.
Exactly. Just in a matter of months.
Was it months?
That critical time of 1940.
Remarkable. Of the three, you would say that Murrow and Winant were the best friends. Similar kinds of philosophies about what the role of America was in the world and helping the underprivileged and the poor, etc. Why is it that we know very little about this guy?
About Winant?
Yeah.
That is a question for me even to this day. He was a former governor of New Hampshire, a liberal Republican who had been an ally of Franklin Roosevelt's since the beginning of the Roosevelt administration. So much of an ally that he basically sacrificed his political career in support of Roosevelt and the New Deal. I mean, the Republicans didn't want anything to do with him. He was really Roosevelt's man. And when Roosevelt named him to be ambassador, he did, as you said, replace Joseph Kennedy, who was very appeasement-minded, who had basically said publicly that he thought Britain was going to be defeated, who told Roosevelt that the U.S. should not give any aid to Britain. So he was not popular, to put it mildly, in England. So he was not a hard act to follow. But Winant was just totally the opposite of Kennedy. He arrived in England in March 1941, which was the worst part of the war for Britain. And from the moment he stepped on British soil, he made very clear that he was there to stay. And, you know, he would walk the streets of London during the worst raids of the Blitz and ask everybody he came in contact with what he could do to help. I mean, he really showed the best side of America to the British, and they loved him for it. And yet, he is not remembered to this day. He is remembered in England, but not in his own country. The reasons are various, I think. He was very much behind the scenes. He was a shy, unassuming man. He did not like the spotlight. He also died at a very young age. He killed himself right after the war. So I think that his suicide has had something to do with the fact that he has been pushed into the shadows of history. But it really is a shame because he really deserves a lot more credit than he's been given.
Tell us what a tough act to follow. The speech that he gave, Churchill, of course, this master of words, and he had to follow Churchill early on after his arrival there, and he spoke this kind of halting English, and but spoke it from the heart, and how the newspapers responded to what he had to say.
Right, that was just shortly after he had arrived. There was a big luncheon at the Savoy, I believe, hotel in London, and everybody who was anybody in London was there, you know, British, I mean, military, government, etc. And Churchill got up and gave this fantastic speech about, you know, Mr. Ambassador, we welcome you to England. Our cause is your cause. And it was just brilliant, as most of Churchill's speeches were. And then Winant got up and he was a terrible speaker normally. He was just terrible. He had a very hard time getting his words out. And he hemmed and hawed for a minute or two. But then he just took off. And he talked about how America was coming finally, but he didn't praise America. The people he praised were the British, and his the speech just gathered power and power and power. And finally, at the end of the speech, everybody in the room stood up and gave him a standing ovation. And the British newspapers were wowed by it. I mean, you know, they were desperate to have an American representative who really cared about what they were going through. And they saw it in Wynette, who was halting and yet incredibly passionate about what he was doing there, and the help that he was going to try to bring to the British people.
Not that we can ever fully understand this, but do we know, do we have indications of why he committed suicide?
There were a lot of different reasons. He was a depressive to begin with, a workaholic whose whole life was bound up in his work. He had had an unhappy relationship. He had had a wartime love affair with Sarah Churchill, who was Churchill's middle daughter, and that did not end well. He basically wanted to help kind of revive the world, but when Franklin Roosevelt died in April 1945, there was nothing left for him. He was Roosevelt's man, and when Roosevelt was gone, the new Truman administration really had nothing for him. They were more interested in toughness at that point, you know, that our former wartime ally, the Soviet Union, was now our enemy in the Cold War, and so we had to be tough. And the idea of an idealist like Wynette, who was very much devoted to helping people, that was not the mantra of the Truman administration at that point. It later became that with the Marshall Plan, et cetera, but not at that point. So Wynette had nothing. There was nothing left for him to do. And he was also exhausted, as most of the people who had anything to do with the war, whether politically, you know, whether in the government or militarily or whatever. I mean, a war is an exhausting, enervating experience, regardless of where you are. And he was totally exhausted and ill, and I think all of that played into his decision that he had nothing to live for.
Mm-hmm. You write about that. It made me exhausted just to read the words of how the British responded, people dragging themselves to work and making it to work, even though their places were in rubbles. They had been bombed, and they had to pull themselves out of their basements. It was a time of maybe 2 hours of sleep a night, 3 hours of sleep a night, and yet people still showed up.
That's the incredible thing about London and the rest of Britain during the war, particularly during those early years, 1940, 1941, when in the incessant bombing raids, the courage and the resolution that they showed and the toughness they showed and not giving in is really quite remarkable, you know, and the sense of humor about it, too. You know, that was a London that really impressed. And Britain, I keep saying London, but it's the rest of Britain too, that really impressed Americans like Murrow and Wynette and Harriman, and made them feel even more strongly that we, the Americans, had to help them.
Talk about this. I would imagine this is not an easy task. You write that the British approached the alliance from the point of view that the Americans had everything to learn and the British were there to teach them. Americans took the approach that if anyone had anything to teach them, it was not the British, who had been beaten over and over again and were not a very good army. Wynette sought to educate citizens of the two countries about each other.
That's absolutely true from the beginning of the alliance. You know, I think there's kind of a conventional wisdom that this alliance, the Anglo-American alliance, which is really one of the most important alliances in military history, was a given. I mean, that it was going to happen, and that when it happened, it, you know, it was a given that it was going to succeed. But neither of those ideas, those pieces of conventional wisdom, was true. It was not a given that it was going to happen, and that once it did happen after Pearl Harbor, it was a very tension filled, problem-laden relationship between the two countries, who, although we have a common heritage and a common language, there's a lot of ignorance and a lot of misunderstandings about each other's history and about each other's political and military situation. And as you indicated in reading that little passage, Americans thought that the British were really condescending and patronizing to them, kind of treating them as like, you know, misbehaving colonists rather than independent allies. So there were all these tensions going on. And one of the major contributions that Wynette and Murrow particularly played was in educating each country from the top officials on down about the other. I mean, Murrow did it in his broadcast, not only to American listeners, you know, through CBS, but he also broadcast on the BBC talking to the British about Americans. But Wynant did it as well. He gave a lot of speeches throughout Britain about Americans and America. He sent out a lot of Americans who were in London, including Murrow's wife, Janet, to go around the country and talk about America. And also when you know, that great horde of American servicemen arrived later in the war to prepare for the invasion of Europe, Wynant made it a special, devoted himself to trying to educate these GIs about their hosts and you know, what they were going through. So this is a duty that both Wynant and Murrow took on for the duration of the war.
Hmm. You would think that we would know everything about each other.
Yeah,
we had a long history,
you know,
but we didn't.
I knew everything when
right.
I started research on this book, but it was really interesting how, you know, from Roosevelt and Churchill on down, they thought they understood each other, but they really didn't.
Right. We haven't spoken of Harriman, different kind of background than Wynant and also Murrow, coming from industry. His father is a big, impressive guy. He really wanted this. Did he lobby actively to get this Lend-Lease job?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He was. He had taken over from his father. He was the head of Union Pacific. But he very much had wanted to be at the center of the action, you know, in the Roosevelt administration, and tried very hard to get a job from the beginning of the New Deal and never was able to do that. But he did manage to get this job, this Lend-Lease job, mainly through the good offices of Harry Hopkins, who was Roosevelt's chief and most influential aide. Hopkins and Harriman were very, very close friends, and Harriman managed to persuade Hopkins to persuade Roosevelt to let him have this job. And this job, this Lend-Lease job in London, really started Harriman's career as a diplomat, which is what he became best known for later in his life.
And the philosophies of the three were quite different. You talk about Wynant and Murrow being close friends who, after the war, championed post-war economic and social reform and international cooperation, reflecting America's idealistic side. And we've got Harriman, who's an exemplary right of U.S. exceptionalism in the post-war era.
That's right. Yeah, the three of them were very, well, different. I mean, Wynant and Murrow were very much like idealists, moralists, and Harriman was really basically out there not only to promote himself and to get ahead, but also to promote the influence and of his own country, which he was very, very good at doing both. I mean, he was very, very good at putting himself at the center of everything that was going on during the war, but also in terms of advancing the interests of the United States.
Was it obvious as you were doing the research for this book that these were the three guys, or did you have to think, well, maybe Eisenhower should be in here? And did you have to debate who was going to be?
That's a very good question. I did. Actually, I decided to do the book really when I found out about Wynant, because I wanted to bring him to public attention, but I didn't want to do just him. And I thought, okay, who are the important Americans in London? And I did come up with these three. I did kind of struggle with Eisenhower and was going to put him in, but the fact is that Eisenhower was in London only for altogether a little over a year. I mean, he came in 1942 and spent a number of months there, but then he went to North Africa as head of the invasion of North Africa, and then he came back when he was assigned to be commander of D-Day, basically, of the invasion of Europe. But then again, he was only there for about 3 or 4 months before he went on to Europe. So he was incredibly important, and I talk a lot about him in the book, but he didn't spend, you know, a huge chunk of time in London, and that's why I decided not to make him one of the main people.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour is Lynn Olson. She is the author of the just-released Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest and Finest Hour. Those three key American players, Edward R. Murrow, Averell Harriman, and John Gilbert Wynant. And it's quite a story. I, of course, have always been fascinated by Edward R. Murrow, but it goes into even more detail about the impact that he had, the access that he had to Winston Churchill. And we have to talk about the romance there, too, not with Winston Churchill, with one of his daughters, and the access that he had to Roosevelt and the impact that he had on the American people. Wynant, as Lynn says, we learn a great deal about because we don't remember him very much from this period in history, important period in history, and we learn a lot more about Harriman as well. Well, here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. And that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Many of you are scholars of World War II or scholars of broadcast journalism and know the great contributions of Edward R. Murrow and understand this period in history pretty well. Unfortunately, many people who were alive and fighting then are passing away, but there may be some of you who remember what your parents had to say about this time, and perhaps your fathers were there in London during this time, or there may be some of you who are alive who were there yourselves. At any rate, we'd like to hear from all of you. Lines are open, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone lines are open for you. Maybe a couple of you have had a chance to read the book. I know you'll be impressed with it. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. And our guest is the author of the totally absorbing new book, Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. Well, we talked a little bit about Wynant's relationship with Churchill's daughter, Sarah, but the other ironic thing about this, we may as well get a little gossipy, because it seems so strange. All three men had wartime love affairs with Churchill family members. Isn't that something?
It really is. And you know what? I think what it reflects is Churchill's determination to court them. I mean, he wooed all three of these guys, and he did it not only by giving them access to himself and to members of his government, but he also really made them members of his family, particularly Wynant and Harriman. I mean, both of those men spent many, if not most, of their weekends with the Churchills at the various country houses that they stayed at. And as a result of this, the three obviously were around the Churchills a lot, and all three of them did, in fact, have wartime romances with members of his family.
And yet, Murrow's wife was there, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, all three of them were married. Murrow was the only one whose wife was in London at the time. But, you know, it's hard to describe, but London during the war was just an amazing place, as a lot of places are during the war. Wartime,
right.
War kind of throws everything on its ear. I mean, it's, there was a mentality, kind of a live-for-the-day mentality there. And these three guys, in many ways, live for the day. I mean, Murrow and Harriman were involved with Pamela Churchill, Churchill's daughter-in-law, not at the same time, I should add. And as I already mentioned, Wynant was involved with Sarah Churchill.
So do you think that Churchill deliberately made these women available? He'd have coffees and they would be alone together? Or?
That's really a good question, and it's asked a lot. No, I don't think he did it deliberately. I think it happened, but he didn't put any roadblocks in the way. The relationship that's particularly interesting in this regard is the one between Harriman and Pamela Churchill. That relationship started just a couple of weeks after Harriman arrived in 1941, and Churchill, when he was confronted by his son about it, who was not surprisingly outraged, denied that he had any knowledge. But both Pamela Churchill and most, I think, historians believe that he, in fact, did know. It would have been hard to not know what was going on under his own roof. My feeling is that, although I'm sure he was not thrilled with this at all. I mean, he loved his son, even though his son could be a real pain sometimes, to put it mildly. Churchill never let his own personal interests override national interests. And if it was good, if he thought it was good for Britain, you know, that he was not going to stand in the way of it. And you know, it's, I think both that relationship that Pamela had with Harriman was kind of helpful for both men. I mean, she kind of served as a conduit, you know, a funnel of information back and forth to the two men. So, you know, it's a very strange, obviously, a very
yes.
strange situation. But I really don't think, you know, Churchill deliberately set out to have this happen.
Huh. Well,
but once it happened, I don't think, you know, he wasn't going to do anything to stop it.
It's so fascinating. Maybe he should have sealed the deal by making Janet Moreau available to his son, huh?
Well, you know, the other two relationships, you know, I don't think the Moreau-Pamela relationship occurred later in the war, and I don't think he had, I don't even know if he knew about it, quite frankly. And the Sarah Winant relationship, I don't think that that bothered him.
Right. Let's go back to Roosevelt for a moment, and if we could look at where he was and the isolationism that was being expressed here in the United States, what his thoughts were about that, his skepticism of Britain's chances in being able to defeat the Nazis, mm-hmm. how much persuasion had to take place?
Roosevelt was really cautious. I mean, I find Roosevelt's actions and attitudes to be just fascinating during this time. He very much wanted to help Britain. There's no question about that. He did not want Britain to go down. He wanted to give Britain as much aid as he could. At the same time, he didn't want to go to war. And I truly believe he did not want to go to war until the day of Pearl Harbor. He was very cautious. He did not want to get ahead of American public opinion. Isolationism was still strong until the end of 1941, until Pearl Harbor happened. Congress was very isolationist. And so he was faced with all these problems, and he did not want to go too far. There were a number of people in his own administration, top people in his own administration, who thought he was being way too cautious, that he should be educating the American public about why it was important to save England, to save Britain, and that we might have to go to war. But he didn't do it. He would take a couple of steps forward and then one step back. And that continued until December 7th, 1941.
And did he deliberately send, this is your mission, Winant and Harriman, to evaluate how strong Britain was, whether or not they could win this? Was that a direct message that was given to both of them?
Yeah. No, he deliberately wanted them to be his eyes and ears in Britain. He wanted them to report back. He told both of them. He wanted them to report back on what was going on. He also wanted them to give the message to the British people that help was on the way. But, you know, there wasn't all that much help on the way, as it turned out. So they had a very, very difficult mission to the British people and to the British government. They both Winant and Harriman did their best to convince the Roosevelt administration that much more aid was needed. And they worked with Churchill and his government to kind of put the best face forward for the American government. So, you know, they were very involved in kind of getting the message out to both governments. They were very much involved in that.
Pearl Harbor Day, as I recall, Moreau is with FDR and Winant and Harriman are with Churchill?
That's right. Yeah, I think that shows the importance of these three men.
Yeah, I think it does.
That's actually right. Absolutely right. That Winant and Harriman were at Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's official country house, with Churchill the night of Pearl Harbor when they heard about Pearl Harbor, and Moreau happened to be at the White House with Roosevelt. He had been invited to dinner with the Roosevelts that evening. He and his wife that evening. So they, all three of them, got firsthand glimpses of these two key leaders at this incredible time.
Did Churchill dance around the room?
Well, One observer said, yes, that he and Wynant did kind of a little dance around the room when they heard about Pearl Harbor. They did not know what had happened. All they knew was that the Japanese had attacked. They did not know the extent of the loss of life or the loss of ships and planes. All they knew was that America was now in the war, and they were, obviously very happy about that, that America was now on the side of Britain.
Hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Lynn Olson is our guest, author of the just-released Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood With Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. Gary from Appleton, hi.
Good morning. I was wondering if your guest could detail the influence that Murrow had on the United States foreign policy, not only as it directed towards the Nazis in World War II, but also with regards to Russia and the Soviet Union. Did he have much influence?
I don't think he had that much influence. It's very interesting, Murrow's take on the Soviet Union during the war. He was very much a supporter of the Red Army and what they were doing, but he was always quite cautious about the Soviet government and Stalin and what his plans were for the end of the war. Murrow had a lot of sources in London with the governments in exile, for example, the Polish government in exile, who were telling him that Stalin had designs on Poland and the rest of Eastern Europe, and that was certainly not the message that was coming out from Britain and from America at that time. So he had he knew that things were not exactly what they seemed to be, that the alliance was not this rosy relationship, this wonderful relationship that Churchill and Roosevelt were saying. So he tried to get a little bit of caution into his broadcasts, and it cost him some amount of trouble. CBS didn't particularly like that, but he tried to get across what was really going on.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. The other thing that you fully realize reading your book and reading his words, how incredibly dangerous this job was, and how dangerous it was to be walking the streets of London at this time as well. The BBC was bombed. The people in houses all around the Murrow's house were bombed. This was relentless bombing for a long period of time during the Blitz, and so many people died.
That's right. Yeah, tens of thousands of British citizens were killed during the war from these bombings. And it was. Murrow and his fellow correspondents were coming under bombing themselves all the time. They were citizens of London. And so they knew firsthand what it was like to be in danger, pretty much 24 hours a day, unlike most Americans who, back here, there was no bombing and no danger. So what he tried to get across to Americans was he tried to put them into the shoes of the British and to let them see what it was like to live day to day in this kind of situation.
Thanks for your call, Gary. We go next to Bill from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to disagree with your guest's subjective analysis of Roosevelt's posture and attitude prior to us entering the war. Everything I've read about the history of the war indicates that Roosevelt was very strongly in favor of entering the war, but being a politician and knowing the mood of the country and Congress, there wasn't anything he could do to move us forward. And that also led to the speculation that he had advance warning in Pearl Harbor and let it happen as an excuse to get into the war.
Well, you're right. We do disagree because I think there's a lot of scholarship in the last few years has really come down on the side of that, yes, he did. He did want to help, but that he was going to do everything he could to see if he if we could stay out. I mean, that obviously didn't happen. And as to Pearl Harbor, I mean, from that was not one of the main focuses of my research, but everything that I have read, and I've read a lot about it, leads me to indicate that, that he did not know ahead of time. He and Churchill certainly knew that an attack was about to take place, a Japanese attack. There's no question about that. But I believe that he did not know that it was going to be Pearl Harbor, and neither did Churchill. Mm.
Thanks very much for the call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. It was Murrow's belief, and I wonder if he expressed this on the air, Lynn, that if Hitler and company were not stopped in London, in England, the next stop was Manhattan.
I don't know that he ever did that overtly. I don't think he ever did that overtly, but it certainly was his opinion. And as I said, his broadcasts, while not overt, certainly, you know, I think he transmitted that idea to the American people in what he said. He did not editorialize that blatantly, but certainly he left no doubt that that's what he believed.
Lynn Olson, our guest. The book is Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address, if you'd like to send one of those, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lynn Olson, our guest, our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join the conversation. As it reaches out, you write more to the world, America might do well to look back at the success of the U.S.-British alliance in World War II and the yeoman work of Wynnette Murrow, Eisenhower, and others in holding it together while nationalism and other forces threatened to tear it apart. You then talk, Lynn, about a speech that Wynnette gave in dedication ceremonies for a monument in southeast England to honor the American forces who landed in France on D-Day. Can you talk about what he said then and whether or not Wynnette and Murrow particularly, what they would have thought of subsequent American involvement in various countries in the world?
Well, his speech was about D-Day, but he was looking forward. He was saying that it was really important to make another country's problems your own. In other words, that this international teamwork and cooperation was absolutely necessary after the war. And he said, you know, it's going to be really difficult. He said, you know, it may be almost impossible, but he said, so was D-Day. The D-Day was almost impossible. We accomplished that. We achieved that. It was a success. And if we put our minds to it, we can do the same after the war. That did not happen, obviously. And I think, you know, we were talking about his state of mind before he killed himself in 1947, and I think that entered into it. Hmm. You know, that the Cold War, that there were far more tensions than anybody had expected or hoped for at the end of the war, that there were rivalries and you know, that really, really, really upset him, as it did Murrow. And I think that both of them, you know, if Wynnette had had a chance to actually continue on in what he was doing, I think he would have made it his life's work to try to correct that. You know, whether he could have done anything at that point, you know, probably not. But and Murrow, you know, after the war, was really distressed about what was going on in the world, and he too tried to continue his educating responsibility and in talking to the American people how important it was to create partnerships, not only between countries, but between people. So he didn't give up on that whole idea, but he certainly didn't make much headway either.
Right, right. What about there's an interesting part where you talk about their being given a chance to get some respite, and I can't remember who it was, went to Ireland at mm-hmm. some point where the war wasn't raging. You would think that after all this pounding and bombs and deadlines and no sleep and too many cigarettes and too much coffee that you would just want to go sit and look at the sea. But once they did that, they felt guilty about being away from London, or were they certainly wanted to be back there?
Yeah, I think that people who were in London during the war, many people who were in London, could not really stay away from it. You know, they felt guilty about leaving and you know, and going to what they called bolt holes, you know, where there was no war. They thought back about, Murrow did this too. The person you described was another correspondent who went to Ireland and couldn't stand it at all. Murrow was the same way. He went to Lisbon one time, and he was there for, you know, a day or two and longed to get back to London, because that was, they wanted to be with, as I said before, they were citizens of London. They wanted to be with other Londoners going through what they were going through. And the ones who actually went back to the U.S., I think, had it even harder. You know, they went back to a country that really wasn't in the war in the sense of the bombings and in the sense of rationing and all the other difficulties that the British had. And there was a real disconnect between mm-hmm. Americans and British and what they were going through. And it was very difficult for those who had been in London to see that.
Yeah, your book definitely describes that disconnect very well with great detail. I felt that. What about the relationship that ultimately developed between Roosevelt and Churchill? Describe in more detail the influence of these three men on deepening that relationship. It wasn't really much of a close relationship. The stereotypes were pretty amazing early on. How would you ultimately describe what developed between FDR and Churchill?
I think they did develop a closer relationship. They did not know each other really when the war began. They had met each other one time in 1918, and Churchill couldn't even remember that, which bothered Roosevelt immensely. In the early years, before they really had developed their own relationship, these three guys really helped kind of explain each of them to the other. Once they finally did start meeting together, they did develop a friendship, but it was not anywhere near as close or as warm as Churchill later made it out to be in his memoirs. It was a pragmatic friendship, I think. Actually, you know, Pamela Churchill was asked years later whether they would have become friends if not for the war, and she said, absolutely not. They had nothing in common, absolutely nothing in common. Huh. But they knew they had to be friends, you know, for the duration, and they both worked at it. Churchill worked at it far more, I think, than Roosevelt, but they knew that they had to develop a relationship that would see them through, yeah. And they did.
Here's an email that's come in. Please talk more about Joseph Kennedy as anti-British is the question. Contrast Harriman with Joe Kennedy, and a question about whether or not Harriman had interests in Germany at the time.
Joe Kennedy was, you know, a supporter of Neville Chamberlain. He was a businessman, I think, first and foremost. He was pragmatic. You know, there was no idealism about Joe Kennedy at all. He did not like Churchill. In fact, he detested Churchill and vice versa. And I think he helped poison the well between Churchill and Roosevelt early on. Harriman, like Kennedy, was a businessman, but he did not have any interest in Germany. He had other business interests in other places in Europe. But Harriman was anti-Nazi very, very, very early on, and was a very strong supporter of the idea very early on that the U.S. had to go to Britain's aid. There was nothing in common, really, between Joseph Kennedy and Averell Harriman.
Mm-hmm. And talk about Kennedy leaving. He left in a hurry, along with quite a few Americans.
Yeah, he left. Actually, he left in October 1940, but actually wanted to leave earlier. He did not like the Blitz. He was every night of the bombing raids, he would leave London and go out to the countryside for the night, and then come back in. You know, he was not really one of those citizens of London that we've been talking
right.
about. He left in October 1940, which was the height of the Blitz, and returned to Washington saying, you know, Britain is gone and I'm for appeasement 1,000%.
And Merle, let's go back to him for a moment. And his feelings, anti-Nazi feelings, those developed very early. I would say long before he went to Europe, didn't they?
Yes, I think they did, but they were certainly intensified when he got over there and you know, was actually on the scene when Hitler began taking over various countries. He was, for example, in Austria, in Vienna, after the Anschluss, you know, when German troops marched into Austria. And he saw for himself what was going on, what the Nazis were doing to the Jews. And he was more than shaken by it. I mean, he was appalled. It brought home to him the evil of Hitler and his regime. And you know, from that time on, even before that time, he was just a staunch opponent of Germany and what they were doing. And he made no bones about it.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about Winant and how the British took to him. How did they feel about Harriman and Merle, for that matter?
You know, most of the British did not really know about Harriman. He was not really in the public eye in that sense. Everybody in the government knew him, and the you know, the top political and social circles in London knew him. But he was not really widely known among the British people. Merle was. Because he did a number of broadcasts, as I said, on the BBC, so he was quite well known. But the one who was the best known, the one whom the British people loved, was Winant. You know, it's hard to believe, and I have found it very hard to believe in the beginning of my research that virtually everybody in that country knew who the American ambassador was. I mean, that's just incredible.
And if you did a poll,
they did.
Isn't that? If you did a poll now, I'll bet 90% of Americans wouldn't have a clue who Winant was.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's really remarkable because everywhere I go. You know, when I talk to journalists or government officials, and these are people you'd think,
right.
if anybody would know, they would know, but nobody knows who he is.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank goodness for your book, right? Thank goodness for your book. The other thing that they must have been doing, at least in Murrow's case and probably the other, is this guy he's doing broadcasts for the BBC, he's, you know, reporting when bombs are going off. It sounded like they were working all the time, were they?
Oh, they were. They were working pretty much nonstop. You know, Janet Merle used to complain that he had no time for her at all, ever.
Right.
Most of that was because he was working all the time from, you know, early morning to late at night. He made his broadcasts late at night because remember that the U.S. was 5 hours earlier, so he was making live broadcasts. And he didn't have time to do virtually anything else, nor did Winant. Harriman, I think, his schedule was not quite that bad, but almost as bad. But they literally they worked around the clock.
Yeah.
For all the war, not just the time before we got into the war.
Right. And when they came back to the United States, we talked about the tragic end of Winant.
Mm-hmm.
What happened with Harriman? And Merle, of course, went on to even more of a distinguished, if it could possibly be. His work in London was absolutely extraordinary, but he went on to a long broadcast career here.
That's right, yeah. You know, he did, and became probably the best known broadcast journalist in the country. There's no question about that. But you know, I think his heart always was back in London until the end of his life. He considered those years, those terrible, glorious years, the most important years of his life, and always thought of himself as a Londoner. Harriman, on the other hand, just went on, and you know, that it was an important time. But you know, what he did in London helped him become the you know, the prominent diplomat that he later became. And I don't think he really gave London that much of a thought afterwards. But for Winant and Merle, London was the key time of their lives, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much for being with us, Lynn. I just loved your book. I love what you choose to do books about, too. If I could write a book, I'd do something similar. But it's so well written as well and absorbing. And And now maybe time for a book totally to unwind it?
I doubt it. I think this is it for Wynant. He's such a fascinating character that maybe you're right. I don't know.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Our guest this hour, Lynn Olson. The book is Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. It has just been published by Random House. And you know, I read a lot of books for this program. Maybe it's the subject matter, and he's a hero of mine, Edward R. Murrow, but just to learn about Wynant and Harriman and this time in history, it's a totally absorbing book. All right. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks to Chrissy for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11, having some interesting conversations. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network.